That's very much a part of it. Overseer politics, the politics of overseer. Overseers did not have title on enslaved people at all, but they could rent them. Poor white people could rent enslaved people, like how you rent a U-Haul truck.
So, what is it that you love about being black?
That's a great question, Nanny Keenan. I love being black because I'm different from everybody else. And the second reason, because black people can do anything they set their minds to.
What I like about being black is just freaking amazing. We are amazing.
Every day is a good day for breathing.
My favorite part about being black is the originality.
I love being black because I can put my hair into different shapes and sizes, and nobody can ever tell me how my hair can be.
I do like the food.
When people say black girl magic, that's for real. That ain't just because we just want to say that. It's real. We magic.
We are so unique in everything that we know.
Go ahead, say it. Please say it.
Please say black.
Please say black.
Please stay black.
Please say black.
As I always was black.
So today we have almost Dr. Lisa Betty, and I can't tell you how transformative this powerful black woman is out in these internet streets. out just in the planet. And so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to get Lisa to tell us a little bit more about herself and who she is in the world and what she does in the world.
Okay, I'm Lisa Betty. I'm currently a PhD candidate working on my dissertation. That's where the almost comes from. I am a lot of things, but I am basically Lorna Betty's daughter and Hartabel Kemp Miller Betty's granddaughter. My family is from Jamaica, and that means a lot to me. My family was also a part of a lot of the rebellions and revolutions that happened against the British Empire within Jamaica. So that also means a lot to me. A family of farmers, healers, nurses, midwives. And that has been very much a part of kind of an identity that I claim and want to cultivate and be a part of those spaces and understand those spaces. My work is about Caribbean migration when I'm writing. Caribbean migration throughout the Spanish Caribbean and then to a kind of particularly the urban north, so places like New York and Boston and even DC. But outside of that, within the internet streets or social media, I post about a whole just a slew of things. But it's a lot of advocacy through social media, gaining understanding about veganism, what it is, what it isn't, spaces in which it as a mainstream social justice movement has been highly problematic, about local politics and what's going on, international politics, reparations, white supremacy, anti-blackness, colorism, desire capital. I go into a lot of different things, and sometimes I repost, say, interesting articles. Other times I cultivate, you know, organic and original pieces. It is unpaid and a lot of labor, as Kina knows. So we do our best in these internet streets, but we create like, I guess, a support system amongst ourselves. And then there's also people that we all always look up to and we connect with on this work, because this work is very important work. This is griot level work, because we're keeping the memory. In a lot of spaces, a lot of narratives very much are manipulated and manipulate us, pathologize Black people, Black women, Black femmes as certain things, give stories and narratives that just aren't true or without context. So our role, I see my role as a corrector. I correct the narrative. I circulate counter narratives that are important. I provide nuance that's important. I provide context that's important. Because as a historian, and then just as a griot, and as someone who knows how damaging narratives have, just narratives, just a story, has been to Black people, period, I think it's always important for us, particularly to create, to support, to circulate counter narratives that tell the real and the right story. So I've been a part of those spaces. That's the spaces that I see myself as a part of, cultivating those counter narratives that really push beyond and allow us to stay on the path of decolonization or questioning things. And I see, you know, decolonization is an internal process. Of course, it's external and it's material. We need land, but at the same time, we need our own sovereign spaces, own sovereign nation states and all of that. But decolonization also has to happen within the scope and scape of people's minds, because there's no way we can actually get the material if people are being okay with being fed the manipulating, perverse version of who we are as a people, of our history, of the history of the world.
Sis, you said a mouthful. As I knew you would, as I knew I would appreciate. And, you know, I was listening to you and I thought about something, and, you know, wherever we draw our spiritual and like metaphysical strength from, ancestral wisdom, you know, the divine, however you, whatever it makes sense for you, but it feels so full circle, because part of this podcast, it's like one component of the Anti-Blackness Reader Project. And part of why I created that platform is because as an academic, we're trained to use the language, we're trained to support institutions that can be anti-Black. And it was really important to me to be able to take all of the content, everything that I learned in academia, and find a way to make it matter to myself, to make it matter to my family, to make it matter to my community, because those institutions, those organizations, those spaces they really don't support us giving that information back to Black people. And it made me think about the first time I read, it was a study on adultification. And it was one of those New England, whatever, fancy journals, you know, that 13 people read. And I remember thinking, this is information that my siblings need to know. This is information that people who live on my block need to know, right? This is shit that Black people need to know. But how will they know it if it's in this New England journal that was created for 13 white folks? And so thank you for honoring my heart and my intention here, because it really was just that fast, like this full circle moment of reminding me why I've made a carved out space in my life to have these critical conversations. And what is our due diligence to the community, to the folks, you know, in our communities, outside of our communities, as Black people, to your point, decolonize ourselves and then let that be the momentum we need for Black liberation for all. And so I want to just appreciate you privately, but also publicly, for just being a comrade, right? Because it's very easy, I think, I don't even want to say it's very easy. The way that violence works, these violent machines would have us get the information, get the knowledge, get the degrees, get the credentials, whatever the things are, and further divorce ourselves from the community. And so one has to make intentional choices at all times to stay married to Black liberation.
It's time for the Blackest Thing.
Made it out the neighborhood, made it to the pros.
And this is the part of the episode where we just talk about what's the blackest thing, all right? And Black means so much. It's a wealth of things. It's not one thing, right? But what's the blackest thing you've done this week? So that's what I want to ask.
The blackest thing I did this week was saying that because of the anti-Blackness, the racial trauma that I've experienced on the campus and just in the general space of being a doctoral student at Fordham University, that I do not want to teach this semester. And so I made that, first I thought I made it clear, but then I emailed again this week, the beginning of this week, and I said, I don't think you heard me. I said that I'm not teaching this semester. And that was the blackest thing I did, because so many times we don't even know what the what the outcome is going to be. Being Black is about not knowing the outcome. Like, this can go so left that I don't even know. I may have to pick up and just leave. You know what I mean? This may go so left. So the unknown is a part of when I think about the blackest thing. Other than like the cultural things of Black joy that I enjoy, another part of being Black is the unknown, because this could go really bad. Because that's about, I guess that is what partly what Blackness is a part as about, is about the unknown, about the backlash. Me just being here can have a backlash. Me standing up for myself can kind of create a backlash. And so me standing up for myself and saying, I cannot do this because you all are not creating an environment or cultivating an environment where my presence is meaningful, that my presence is a contribution to the space, and that the students can feel that energy, that I don't really belong here and I'm really not that important. And so since they can feel that energy just as they walk in the campus, my presence is unimportant to them. And I felt the tension, and I just couldn't do it for another year. Mind you, I'm in the last phase of my, you know, dissertation and all that. So it's kind of like, not to say I have options, but I'm using the options that I don't even know if I have them. I can't. So it also makes me know that to be safety, the blackest thing that you can do for yourself, other than joy, and joy is also part of safety, is assure your safety by any means necessary.
The conversation we're having about the symbolic acts really kind of lends itself to this overarching conversation we're having today, which is respectability politics and what that has meant in the past, but to a certain extent, what that means today, because I do feel like those things go together. The things that a certain part of our community would say are wins, and some of us would say, that's not a win, that's just an empty gesture. And so I think this is a really beautiful way to think about, what are we naming as the respectability politic that still lives today? Is Cory Booker someone who we feel like is saying, yeah, these are the things that should happen, but do we feel like those are divorced from what the community is actually asking for right now? So I would love to know, I guess let's start with, what is your take on respectability politics? If you had to define it for the people, how would you define it, Lisa?
It's in the space of Black excellence. It's very much plug words, Black excellence, hashtag Black excellence, hashtag Black capitalism. Sometimes even hashtag Black dollars, that's a part of it. hashtag, like, this is, you know, nuclear family, replicated the nuclear family in all types of ways. Also, it's very fat phobic, very transphobic, very much a sex negative, meaning, you know, a woman have to kind of conduct themselves in a very specific and particular manner. And that manner is very much attached to the spectrum of desirability. We could talk, you know, desirability, desire capital, all that kind of stuff. Spectrum of that within just mainstream, what we see as mainstream Black communities.
I would add to all of the great stuff you said, it is like this whole, this belief that upholding mainstream norms, values, is a form of protection, right? Yeah. For people who have been marginalized, who've been under-resourced, underrepresented. And it's a profitable enterprise, right? It's a strategy of survival. So if we are doing the things that maintain the status quo, uplift the status quo, that is a form of safety and protection, right? Mm-hmm. And so I love the fact that you talked about the, I tend not to call the period after the United States Civil War the R word. I think the only thing that got reconstructed during that time was white supremacy. So I see that era as a failure of policy, a failure of so many different things. But that moment taught us a lot. And so one of the things that I think our ancestors came out of that period of time thinking is, if we just do and assimilate and adapt, then, you know, we can survive white supremacy. We can survive the racial terrorism that we've experienced since we landed over here. And a big part of my decolonization journey on a personal level has been was when I finally realized that I can't out-white my Blackness, right? And that is something that the Academy definitely tried to get me to do. And the second thing I realized, there is no level of adaptation that will restore my humanity to me in white supremacy. And so for me, respectability politic is saying, if we just bend enough in that bending, in that molding, we could become a thing that will be safe. And I mean, I call bullshit, right? But I also recognize that for generations at this point, you still have Black people, especially those baby boomers, who really believe, you know, I would think the first anchor, right? Baby boomers who are like, just live in the right neighborhood, go to the right schools, get all that Black vernacular out of your lips, you know, and then you can succeed and be a part of this American promise.
Definitely. And I'll agree with you that, I mean, in terms of the Reconstruction period, and we can even see this with Reconstruction as a success for white supremacy, and a Reconstruction period is really interesting because it is a space in which we were able to cultivate some of our own. But what is our own? It is based on respectability politics, because that's when the, you know, HBCUs started to come about in types of ways. So a lot of that infrastructure of Black excellence, some of the infrastructure of respectability politics were cultivated during the Reconstruction period. So Reconstruction period can be seen in so many different ways. And Du Bois's Black Reconstruction is also a part of that kind of narrative. It's a very much, not to say a Black excellence narrative, but in a way, look, we had political figures, we had this, we had that, but we still had so many lynchings. We still had white supremacy able to transform itself in so many different ways. So the Reconstruction period, as particularly, I always say it's as a failure for Black people, because sometimes what you have is historians that want to say Reconstruction was a failure because of Black people, because Black people did not value freedom, could not maintain themselves during freedom, you know, pathological BS. So I think just changing the language around that, say Reconstruction was a failure for Black people, not a failure because Reconstruction era really was a time where they learned how to cultivate white supremacy. And we have not gotten out of that cycle. That's why I always move back to the Reconstruction period. Whatever they learned during that period on how to control not only the media, how to use the media against us, how to use their own homegrown militias, the Ku Klux Klan and things like that against us. Like, it's like the same thing that's going on right now. And that all of that was cultivated during the Reconstruction period.
Who's ready for some Black history?
This is your Black History Moment.
For our second segment, we talk about the importance of Black history. So what is the Black history now, right? Because we realize that we're our ancestors' routed streams, but we're also living history, we're artifacts. And so we want to recognize. So this week, something happened that was significant. Maya Angelou, our great ancestor, her likeness gets placed on to the U.S. quarter earlier this week. We have a lot of feelings about that. That is history. It's not only Black history, but I would name it as United States history. The U.S. Treasury minted, signed, sealed, delivered. But what are your feelings about that history that was made? Black history in the moment.
I have different types of feelings because I feel like this is history. It's important to certain people, but I'm very much, particularly, I think in the 1980s, a lot of like symbolic wins, that's when they kind of like began to unfold in particular type of ways. Because then we have like Black capitalism and a lot of Black people in some of the mainstream capitalist industries and things like that. Black excellence cropping up as a like a real type of like thing. And so I think that this feels like a kind of like one of those 1980s Black excellence wins. Even the 2008 kind of like Obama Black excellence win. I think at this point in time, we are way beyond that because there are scholars, there are activists that want us and wanted us to move beyond these symbolic wins and symbolic gestures. They literally have written tons of books about it, articles, blogs, speeches, particularly doing that. So I think that it's important for, I guess, the legislators in particular, like Barbara Lee, and there's other legislators that particularly women legislators that really want to push this through and saw this as an important win. Even Michelle Obama sees this as an important win. But I think it's very much symbolic. And the fact that we don't even use coins anymore, and aren't coins circling out? Like, so I'm kind of also confused. There are not that many coins. They want to like take that out of the system as well. Don't even have to, like 90% of the time, you don't even use coins to the laundromat anymore. If you do use, go to the laundromat. So I'm just kind of even confused where, who's going to even see this. Last time I saw a quarter was probably 2 months ago in my nephew's coin collection.
Look.
I don't have any, like, am I even going to see this quarter?
Look, the kids these days, when the Tooth Fairy comes, the Tooth Fairy ain't giving 50 cent, baby. The Tooth Fairy giving
$5. That's expensive.
This ain't even Tooth Fairy money.
he hustled me. I gave him $5 for his teeth. He's like, listen. That's what
I'm saying. These kids don't want no change, jiggity jangle for the teeth. You got to give them bills.
The price went up.
inflation. But, you know, I feel
today's price is not yesterday's price.
It's not. Yeah. And I feel you on that. I mean, one of the things that I try to really hold on to is like multiple truths can exist at once. And so I'm not going to lie. At first, I side-eyed. I was like, because where's that Harriet Tubman $20 bill though, right? Like that was like the first thing I thought about. And I had a friend, you know, a Black woman, a sister, reach out and say, well, we still get to celebrate this. And so where I kind of land is I agree with you about the symbolic component of this. How have symbols and this is a whole different conversation for another podcast, but like, you know, my first tension here is symbols do not equate to policy. And that is what Black women need. That is what Black families need. That is what Black children need. That is what Black trans folks need. You know what I'm saying? Symbols and policy are not the same thing. And we can have a conversation about, or make space to have a conversation about, how does the symbolic lend itself to policy? Or maybe it doesn't. So really what I'm doing is what I think we can hold is that it could be a celebration for sure, an acknowledgement, but that is not an indicator of progress. And that's where that tension has to be really named, because some people will say, Maya Angelou's on the quarter, progress. And I'm like, the lies you tell, right? So that's kind of where I'm sitting with that, which is we can celebrate that this good sis is being honored in this way, but I am not going to use this to stamp progress on bullshit. And so that's kind of where I ended up landing on the whole quarter situation.
Brittany Cooper has really a activist, academic, just Crunk Feminist Collection is her.
Yes.
One of the best things I know her from, cultural critic, says that it's kind of in the same space as me, because Maya Angelou means a lot to me. The first book that I read 5-6 times and read a whole slew of it when I was 15. Without Maya Angelou and her stories, I don't know if I'd be here in the same way. I don't know if I'd be even a writer or project myself as a writer. So Maya Angelou means so much to me. So that's why I'm just kind of like feeling a bit disrespected by the US government, because we know what this means. We know this is for them to create a narrative and an archive that things weren't that bad. That's what this is about. This is about cultivating an archive that, look, we've resolved this. In addition to what Brittany Cooper was saying, was that for one, there's actual material and real things that Black people have been demanding, particularly Black women, from a Democratic administration, which the United States has right now, like voting rights, that has been a Black issue forever, specifically since 1865. Well, even before that, when we could vote in certain spaces, when they took away the vote in certain spaces, like the 1830s and things like that as well. So voting has always been important. Reproductive rights, issues that are going on, that are trying to repress trans people, you know, that are affecting Black trans people. There's just like so many things. A anti-lynching bill, like Black people still getting lynched. Like, so this is also, and in addition to that, Cooper does talk about too, that Black people being on currency is a slap in the face, because Black people used to be currency. So it's like, this is not a win. 10% of all Black people in the United States that are like, oh yeah, I would, yeah. Everybody else is like, hey, okay, this is just not something that we were all like, there's no consensus on this, or you could talk to every Black person and be like, da da da. You could talk to probably 100 Black people and 99% of them would be like, yeah, reparations. You could talk to, except one fool.
I don't know, because
there's always going to be one fool. I said 100 Black people, you go talk to 99 will say yes. There's going to be one fool. Of course there's going to be one.
I think at this point, we might got to, more than one fool who's going to be like, what? Reparations? What are you doing?
They don't even count. Anyways, I'm just saying there's certain things that are somewhat a consensus that is a logical, material, like win, where people would cry about, people would feel impacted, people that would support Black people for the next 20 to 30 years. This is not that. This is not a 13th Amendment, a 14th or 15th Amendment. This is not that.
Yep.
That's what we need. We need that level of intervention, because after the 15th Amendment, things have been exactly the same. We've been in this kind of like same just kind of cycle where nothing, we didn't even really have a real feasible Reconstruction, like at every point where Reconstruction was about to give us a game, they sent us 10 years backwards. At every point where there was something that we gained, they sent us back. So it's just kind of like, I feel like we need substantial and material wins, not these symbolic. Additionally, Mamie Till and Emmett Till are going to be given, according to whoever I read it, going to be given a medal, maybe a Medal of Freedom. Let me see, something like that from the United States, a gold, congressional gold medal. Mamie Till and Emmett Till. We don't have an anti-lynching bill. Mamie Till don't want a gold medal. If Mamie Till was alive right now, she would throw that gold medal in. And if, like, she wants it, she literally wanted an anti-lynching bill. So, like, this is just kind of like allowing them. And this is where historians can really come in and tell people what's actually happening. They want to create a false record of progress with these ineffective symbolic wins. So 20 years from now, when people are talking about what happened, they can say, well, all of this great stuff happened and Black people still didn't figure it out. And that's why they're still marginalized. And that's why they're still oppressed, because they're oppressed because they oppressed themselves. So they're creating this narrative and this official record of progress that doesn't even make sense in our current space, because no one's asking for these things. And if someone's asking, it's like one or two people. They're saying, well, we can't do this, let's do this. Cory Booker specifically asking for the congressional gold medal. He's leading that for Emmett Till. And so I don't know, maybe in their thought process, that if there are these symbolic wins, that maybe it will create a substantial material win or something like that. I don't know what their logic is. And this is politics, so it's very political, so nothing's gonna make sense. But at the same time, I just think that between the quarter for Maya Angelou and the congressional gold medal for Mamie Till and her son Emmett Till, and then also there being an ABC world premiere movie about the situation while his killer is still alive.
Oh,
yeah. The Carolyn accuser. Bryant Dunham.
Accuser.
Say her name. She's still alive.
He's dead.
She's not dead. She's alive.
I thought she died like last year.
No, she's alive.
Are you sure she's alive?
Yes. She's alive.
Okay.
Listen, she may have faked her death because she.
Okay. This, because there was a book, it was like her End of Days book that came out like 2 years ago, where she's like, he didn't, you know, she confessed. I just assumed that was a deathbed confession.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, she's still alive. It's just there's some substantial material things that need to happen. They don't need a gold medal. They need justice. That woman is still alive. And just speaking in the spirit of understanding the circumstance of what happened to her son, if that pisses me off, she pissed off about it. You know what I mean? I can feel the ancestors, they pissed.
Yeah.
How is she alive in retirement, sitting on a porch, and her son was murdered?
Yeah. And the family members are still left behind with the trauma of that. Like one of his cousins who was in the house when it happened can't talk about it without just tears rolling down his face, and rightfully so. We understand white people and whiteness and white supremacy better than white folks do, right? So when white people say things like, I'm just so surprised, or I just had no idea, or just like, what is going on? Like, look, Becky, look, Karen, you shocked because you ain't read the textbook, but I didn't I done read the textbook. You get what I'm saying? I've read this three times because my survival is predicated on understanding how y'all move. And it is indeed pathological. There is a pattern and it doesn't change. But the insidious nature of white supremacy is that it gets maintained. And, you know, it breaks my heart to say it, Lisa, but the shit doesn't just get maintained by white people. And that's the other component of respectability politics that unnerves me personally, is because it's the ways that we work and have internalized anti-Blackness, have internalized white supremacy, that keeps those machines and mechanisms in order. So you don't necessarily need white people to talk about your colleagues' locks at work, because I can't sit there and be like, that's so unprofessional, right? Mm-hmm. And if you get the Black woman to talk about the other Black person's unprofessional or unkept quote unquote hair, then a white person don't need to say that. And then they could use my cosign and say, well, Keena's the one who said that, you know, locks are unprofessional.
And I thought you should just, I should bring it to your attention.
Look, and I say this as someone who is, who's been delivered and is being delivered. You know, I don't have to talk about something else somebody else did. I'm talking about me. I'm talking about the me who would make the statements or the comments about this, you know, the loud music. Why is it so loud? Or why are they talking like this? And it's like, even now when I say it, my heart beats a little faster. And I have a physical reaction because it's like, I know that I believe so deeply that if I did accommodate what was professional and what was civil, in my mind, that is how you get to Black liberation. And that couldn't be further than the truth. And so I'm thankful for coming on the other side of the street. But I also really mourn the fact that I believed some of those things to begin with.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. Definitely understand all that. It's very much, it's very damaging. You know, I don't like to kind of move us into, I don't like to be like, well, in slavery, they did that too. But you know what? Our entire economic system, our entire social system, our entire police state is based on the plantation system and the plantation economy. Everything is replicated for that because it's the longest standing economy and space that existed in the Western Hemisphere. You know, the gold, that was the first industry, was forced labor, spreadsheets accounting, all of that, the managerial levels, levels of acculturation, levels of management. And a part of that system, because we've only been in the industrial revolutions, when they try to explain it like that, like they just cropped up that, no, this is a 500-400 year system that they became experts at. They began to able to tweak those things during those revolutions. But I think what's super important is that within those, the plantation economies, the industrial economies, which plantation and industrial economy is basically the same thing, even when they call something a plantation, like power plant, plantation.
I can't learn anymore. I can't do anything else with you right now because you have...
You have people like my mom, when she would, at least in Jamaican, even here, you say slave driver, it means someone of a similar status of you that wants to make you work harder. But it's like, why you want to make me work harder? We the same. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, who do you think you are? Big boss? Get out of here. But it comes from that narrative where you would have someone that was from within the community of enslaved people have to maintain the pace, and that person had to maintain the pace and was somewhat also because they would get favors by the overseer or the enslaver or whatever, that really was a form of management as well. Like I'll say like lower middle, like your supervisor. And it's like, they ain't even paying you. You know what I mean? But at the end of the day, that person does have certain status above people. So even that, where you would have, particularly when we're talking historically, that you literally did have Black people who were enslaved that would have to maintain the plantation system. And how grotesque that sounds, that we had to maintain the old system of repression and oppression. But this is how that has worked. That's what we think about. How are there billionaires? How are these people able to have us as cogs in the wheel so easily? This is a 500-year process that they've became experts at in this particular moment. You know, it was difficult. And particularly for in the 1900s, that was probably the most difficult period for the elite class to kind of claim their state and stay there, because you did have so many working class revolutions and poor people getting up and poor people cultivating it. You had all of that stuff. So you had that before, but this is a space in which the 2000s and what we're living in right now, I think it's just a lot easier for them to, this kind of like cog in the wheel, a lot easier for them to, and that's a part of like the politics of celebrity and media and aspiration, kind of, you know, the kind of aspiration of maybe I can be a billionaire that they've cultivated within poor working class, regular type people.
Or maybe I could be an oppressor, which is what they did with poor white people during that age. Is like, you might not own a slave, but one day you might be able to own a slave, so you should sign up with us.
That's very much a part of it. Overseer politics, the politics of overseer. Overseers did not have title on enslaved people at all, but they could rent them. Poor white people could rent enslaved people, like how you rent a U-Haul truck. So when we talk about, well, who has title to people? Well, my people never did it. No, you rented. Because that was a part of the economy. It was also renting human beings to do labor. That was maybe too strenuous. If you wanted to build a house or do this, or you needed, you had a little small farm and it's you and your wife and your kids, but you need some extra manpower for right now, You could rent human labor, forced labor, for 2 weeks.
Lisa, I mean, I knew you were going to be a game changer, and you have not, well, I need to stop saying that under the assignment, because when I found out that a white woman created that whole thing,
she
I was like,
from Texas, a white woman from Texas. You know, but that's our language, though.
That's our language, and I'm convinced that
that's our language, and then they kind of like, just because they can use it once or twice, or
she probably heard some young Black girl say that in a grocery store, and then went ahead and put that, recorded it on the song.
I've heard that before. I heard it in a song.
Okay, so good, great. So we're going to cede it back to us. But you understood the assignment, sis. And I really, you know, I'm thinking about something you said earlier in this episode, right? Which is having that griot identity. And it feels like that identity is one that directly opposes what we've been taught in a respectability politic. So I think it's important for people to understand that connection, why that matters.
So griot is particularly within continental Africa. They are important members of community and societies, African society, traditional African societies, and even societies today. They're poets, they're musicians, they're storytellers. So they're the ones who keep the memories of the community. They're the ones who also kind of speak the truths within society. So it's not only about keeping narratives, it's about well, this was the king, and he wasn't a good king because he did this, and he also did that, and that was, this was his daughter, and his daughter was not a good, you know. So it's keeping the memory, but also making sure people know, you know, getting the narrative straight. Like, we're not going to fake the funk. It's not necessarily nationalism. When we think about national narratives and how it's like, none of that actually happened, and it's all fake. The griot is a different type of, has a different type of role within society. They're supposed to, you know, speak the truth. They're supposed to be the memory. And so it's really important to the oral traditions. You know, we have written languages, of course, all throughout African societies, throughout the continent. But at the same time, the griot is really, 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 really important. And so I take on that identity because I love stories. I was the kid that would just sit with my grandmother as she sewed and listen to her. I was that kid. I had, you know, sometimes my sisters would join us sometimes. But even when my sisters left to watch TV or to do their own thing, I would just sit there and watch her hands and hear her stories and listen to her sing and watch her sew very intensely and see what she was doing. I was that kid. And so that was my training, because it was a very kind of, you have to be patient. You have to listen. You have to watch. You have to ask questions. And so I learned a lot about my family history in that space. My mother is the same way, but she carries a lot of the stories that a lot of people don't know, asking them questions too. Like, even if they, you know, there's an aspect so she can get the story straight out of all, you know, all parts of it. And I do the same. So I think Rio is making sure, is taking on the role of making sure that we have the right story, that we have a clear story. And we have a story that really represents who we are in totality, not who we want to be or who we said we were, but who we actually are in totality. So I take that role very seriously, very seriously.
Is that something you think do you think that's a posture that we should all try to add into our lives and add into our liberation work?
Yes, because I think when we think about griots and how stories are told today, and even say musicians and modern day and hip hop and things like that, people be lying. Like, I shot him in his face. No, you didn't.
Like, you did not, sir. I think the term that you use is stunting for the gram.
Yes, and you have a lot of that too. You have a lot of that too. Photoshop this and that, and look at all my stacks and da 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 da. You know, so you have a lot of fakeness. So we need authenticity. That's a part of it. We need storytellers that are true to themselves, and storytellers that understand that the colonial process is lies. It's like, if I lie, that's being a liar is. It's just like a white supremacist thing. White supremacy will just lie. They don't care. That's a part of white supremacy. Look, the ability remix, to lie.
The remix. All you got to do is talk about Abraham Lincoln. Y'all done remixed the whole shit. Way before he quote unquote freed the slaves, he was sending ninjas off. So I love that you're bringing that up. I mean, that is like the lies y'all done told. And the lies that we internalize that we have to shake back from.
And real recognized real. Harriet Tubman was invited to the White House. She didn't want to go because she said, who is that man, me? He wants us to go where? He wants us to leave the United States? She said, no. She said, I was born here. My father was born here. My grandmother was forced to come here. And this is where I am. This is where my people died. This is where my blood is. And this is the country I'm fighting to create for my nieces and nephews and the people that are coming after me, for my descendants. So no, she didn't go to the White House because she thought that he was the... She had her own words for who he was. You know, she didn't believe that She believed John, if there was a white man that she stood next to and would fight next to and saw as better than Abraham Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln couldn't even touch John Brown. That's a white man she respected. Abraham Lincoln, no. John Brown, that's a revolutionary. That's who really believed in a society that was free of exploitation, that was free of kind of racism, that was free of hierarchies, you know? And he really believed that. So that's the only man, like I'll say, you know, not to say that she didn't sit and talk with different white men, but that's a white man that she sat and had a plan with Harriet Tubman. She didn't want to sit with Abraham Lincoln and talk to him because she knew that he was BSing, bullshitting.
And she was willing to name the truth and tell the truth.
Yes.
And live and the truth.
And she was invited to the White House and she said, no, I decline.
Sis, this has been an amazing conversation. I just think you gave us so, so much richness. And I'm so grateful to be in community with you. Listeners, follow Almost Dr. Lisa Betty on Instagram. Are you tweeting these streets? Is there a place where people can reach you? Like, if they just want to, like, shower you with blessings, where do they go?
So I am on Twitter. I think it's at Lisa V. Betty. But I also have a website where I just have, like, all the stuff, which is lisabetty.com. And it has information there. And, yeah, I think there you could see all the different handles I have. And then also, if you want to make a contribution to any of the work that I do and the information I put out, so I can keep on kind of working in this way, you can go there as well. LisaBetty.com.
All right. This is not going to be the last conversation we have with you. I wish you wellness and fullness. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Much appreciation, Keena.
Thanks for listening to the Please Say Black podcast, and I am so excited to be your host, Joaquina Reed. I hope today's episode really connected to you in a deep way, and I want to encourage you to check out the episode notes. You can find out more information about me, how you can support our podcast, and of course, find out more information about our dope guests. Now we gonna get down. Lastly, make sure you follow us over at Instagram at Please Say Black. I want to leave you with this blessing from our tremendous ancestor, Malcolm X, that says, I pray that God bless you in everything you do. I pray that you will grow intellectually so that you can understand the problems of the world and where you fit into it, into that world picture. And I pray that all the fear that has ever been in your heart will be taken out. So, stay black, say black, and be blessed.
Now, if you don't mind, I would like to get a little rest now.
Catch y'all next time.